Imagine, just for a moment, that you're a Republican running for U.S. Senate in a competitive race in 2018. It's already a challenging atmosphere. Democrats are fired up. Women are pissed off. And every day, there's a new twist in the news. Something the president has said, or allegations against his nominee for Supreme Court, or a new twist in the Russia investigation. So the playing field is already rough. But the president has just announced he's going to come to a rally for you in your state. Here's the thing. It's your state, but it's his crowd. The president will come out to uproarious applause. Then he'll introduce you. When you shake his hand, all those photos of world leaders shaking the president's hand awkwardly come to mind. Then you take the podium. And remember, this is your state, but it's not your crowd. You're the opening act. You're essentially Sonic Youth opening for Neil Young in the early 90s. On top of that, you're probably an elected representative, so when the crowd starts chanting, "Drain that swamp," it's possible they're chanting at you and not with you. But you make it through the speech. You finish. There's applause. Trump retakes the stage. Gives you a little bit more shine. But then, for the next 45 minutes to 1 hour, he's just going to riff about whatever he wants to. He's going to talk about trade deals. He's going to talk about his border wall. He's going to talk about his mother's cooking, maybe. We don't know. He's the president, and this is the way he rolls. He doesn't really work a script. He just improvises on stage. So as you're watching this, you're having mixed thoughts. There are some questions going through your mind. Is he going to say something that's going to get me in trouble and possibly cost me this race? And maybe far in the background, did I just sell my soul? This is Blue Ridge Free State, a podcast about politics, culture, history, and life in Appalachia. I'm your host, Mason Adams. I've been covering the region as a reporter since 2001. You can find me on Twitter at Mason Adams, MasonAtoms, like the atomic particle. I've got a pinned tweet there where you can sign up for my mailing list. Follow the podcast for alerts about new episodes at Ridge Free on Twitter and Facebook. In today's episode, we're going to talk about Donald Trump's recent swing through Appalachia for midterm rallies and the nationwide strategy that's unfolding involving the president. This past week, he was in Wheeling, West Virginia, campaigning for Attorney General Patrick Morrissey, who's in a U.S. Senate race against incumbent Senator Joe Manchin. And then a couple days later, Trump was in Johnson City, Tennessee, campaigning for 7th District U.S. Rep. Marsha Blackburn, who is running as the Republican nominee for U.S. Senate for Bob Corker's open seat. Her opponent is former Governor Phil Bredesen. And so in the first segment today, we're going to talk a bit about the bizarre ritual that is a Donald Trump midterm campaign rally and whether the president can create wins for his candidates by making it about him. Then after that, we'll talk to Jake Zuckerman, the politics reporter for the Charleston Gazette Mail. You can follow Jake at Jake_Zuckerman on Twitter. We'll talk with Jake about the Manchin-Morrissey Senate race, the unexpectedly competitive House race in Southern West Virginia's 3rd District, and how the governor in West Virginia is trying to affect the election this week with an announcement related to the teacher strike earlier this year. Thank you for listening. I have spent my career largely as a journalist of the written word, and this is a new endeavor. Rather than scheming everything out from the beginning, I just decided to jump into it, with my approach being sort of three chords and a cloud of dust. That was my approach for my zine back in 2003, and really kind of how I got into journalism is just by doing it. I was a wildlife major and jumped in. So I couldn't resist dropping another snippet there from Powerbomb Anthems Volume 1, the Gordon Solie Motherfuckers 10-inch that provided me so much inspiration back when I first made my transition to journalism. I mentioned that record here for another reason too, and one that I inadvertently edited out of the first episode, and that is that I am labeling the show as explicit for language. We're not going to go out of our way to cuss, but I've got a few guests in mind who work in profanity like Picasso worked in paint, and I don't want to go out of my way to edit those interviews either. I appreciate all the positive feedback I heard from the first episode, as well as the person who advised me that the game was cranked way too high at points. I've probably tweaked that first episode and dropped it back on our website, BlueRidgeFreeState.com, at least half a dozen times. I also want to shout out Pomac, Roanoke Hip Hopper, who dialed up these beats we're talking over. Check him out at Pomac.com. That's POEMACK.com, or on Facebook at Pomac Music. Thanks also to Stations, whose opening riff from Citizen Youth I appropriated as bumper music. So thank you to that band, who, in the format which I mostly worked with them, was Neil Gillum, Dylan Hendricks, and CJ Stump, and also their drummer, Goat. Rest in peace, Goat. So, speaking of goats, we brought in a new buck over the weekend for fall breeding with our dairy goat herd. Some of you know my family keeps a herd of dairy goats and chickens at our place up on the Blue Ridge Plateau in western Floyd County, Virginia. Mostly we just, you know, for dairy goats, you just keep milkers. But over the weekend, we brought in a buck for the next few weeks for breeding season. And there's a whole process. You know, we had to basically reinforce our buck pen after a couple of years of using it. We needed to replace a couple of the posts and redo the fencing. And then we brought him in, and, you know, you kind of forget every year how disgusting bucks are. And by buck, I mean a billy goat, male goat, male unaltered goat. They are disgusting creatures. They stink. They're totally gross. They pee on their own faces, and then they'll leer at you. They do this lip curl that is somehow the most vulgar expression you can imagine. You know, honestly, they're pretty gross. They're about the only thing a creature I could imagine that would be grosser is the human male. And, you know, as I speak, we're seeing some fights in Washington, D.C. over Donald Trump's nomination for the Supreme Court of the United States, and some of those issues have arisen, and, you know, sort of the news the last week or two, compounded with seeing this male goat, definitely created a visceral reaction in me. Anyway, with that, let's turn to this first segment on Donald Trump's swing through Appalachia this past week.
Incredible state with thousands of hardworking American patriots. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
So the president was in Appalachia this past week. He visited Wheeling, West Virginia on Saturday, September 29th. That was an appearance for Patrick Morrisey, who's running as the Republican challenger to incumbent Senator Joe Manchin. 2 days later, the president was in Johnson City, Tennessee, on Monday, October 1st, and that was for Marsha Blackburn. You know, both these rallies were pretty formulaic. If you listen to our first episode, we talked at some length about the president's mid-August rally in Charleston for Morrisey. This one was pretty similar so far as structure. And, you know, let's talk real quick about the West Virginia race. We'll break them down just briefly by event. You know, then so the Wheeling appearance, that Senate race, both Cook Political Report and Sabato's Crystal Ball at the University of Virginia Center for Politics have it rated as leans Democratic. Everybody seems to agree that Manchin has a marginal lead. Jake Zuckerman and I are going to talk about that a little more this episode. I wasn't there for this rally like I was the one in Charleston, but based on the president's open remarks, it sounded like he came out to Country Roads again by John Denver. He kind of comes out boasting about the economy and the economic numbers.
And our great coal miners are back to work. They're back to work. A lot of people said that wasn't going to happen. You're back to work. Not only back to work, they're opening up mines all over the place. We're opening up steel mills, and the steel mills need metallurgic coal. And those coal miners are working, and the steel workers are working, and our whole country is working.
Then after a couple of minutes, he kind of goes through and sort of nods to the elected officials who are there in attendance. Even though he's in northern West Virginia, Donald Trump spends a little bit of time talking about that competitive race in southern West Virginia in the 3rd District, where he touts Carol Miller, the Republican nominee for that seat, and bangs on Richard Ojeda, the Democrat, fairly hard here, although not by name.
A woman that everybody respects. She is running against a total wacko.
And then he yields the stage to Patrick Morrissey, who walks up, shakes the president's hand, comes up to the podium. He's about half a head shorter than Trump, so he has to visibly pull down the mic. He reads from prepared remarks, gets a decent response. The crowd's definitely hotter for Trump than they are for him. So, you know, interestingly, and I'm kind of fundamental to my underlying point here, is that when Trump takes the stage again, he essentially makes the argument that a vote for Patrick Morrissey is a vote for him.
Remember this, a vote for Patrick Morrissey is a vote to stand up for West Virginia values, right? A vote for Morrissey is a vote for me and for our agenda to make America great again, or as we will soon start saying, keep America great, right? Keep it great.
He wants to make this race a referendum on his presidency with the goal of firing up Trump supporters who might otherwise stay home in an off-year election. Then Donald Trump is off to Spiel City, riffing through his usual assortment of topics, you know, banging on the Democratic Party, banging on the media who cover national politics. And that's where he is. You know, he kind of comes back at the very end to the reason why he's there, Patrick Morrissey. But essentially, you know, the president goes for nearly an hour and a half just on riffing mostly about what he wants to talk about global geopolitics, about trade deals, about the economy, and attacking Democrats generally.
Hello, Johnson City. It is great to be with you. I am thrilled to be back.
Structure-wise, the Johnson City rally 2 days later is pretty similar. This is the U.S. Senate race for Bob Corker's open seat. You know, Cook has this as a toss-up. Crystal Ball has it as leans Republican. So, again, it's a pretty competitive race between Marsha Blackburn, who is in the U.S. House of Representatives, and Democrat Phil Bredesen, the former governor. This crowd is a little bit more fiery than the West Virginia crowd, at least. You know, that's the way they're mic'd. You can hear them chanting for locals a lot more than you could in West Virginia. Like, I don't recall hearing, certainly not in Charleston, and I don't think in Wheeling either. The crowd really didn't go as hot for Morrissey. But, you know, Trump does the sort of same thing here. He comes out, he brags on his presidency up front, introduces elected officials, then he introduces Blackburn. She actually gets a chant for her.
Thank you all so much. Thank you.
And then she's able to mostly elude the traditional handshake. She kind of takes the president by the hand but doesn't really give him a traditional handshake, and whereas Morrissey had to pull the mic down, she actually steps up to it, which comes off as more assertive. You know, and after her speech, Trump makes the same argument: a vote for Republican is a vote for me.
So I just want to thank Marsha Blackburn, and I will tell you, she's all about Tennessee values. That's the one. She's got Tennessee values. A vote for Marsha is really a vote for me and everything that we stand for. It's a vote for Make America Great Again. That's what it is.
So, you know, looking at this strategy, it's easy to kind of chalk it up as Trump's narcissism. And there's something to that. I mean, you know, he essentially spends the vast majority of the time in these speeches talking about what he wants to talk about. But there's an underlying strategy here, too. National environment is not tend to be good for the party in control of the White House, you know, especially when you've got the White House, the House, and the Senate. If you look back to the Obama presidency, you know, that was the case in 2010 when Democrats held Congress and the White House. In 2010, Republicans won 63 seats in the House and 6 in the Senate. That happened in part because Democrats did not turn out in nearly the numbers they had for the historic 2008 victory. That's what Trump's trying to avoid by making this all about him. You know, midterm elections tend to skew older and more conservative. But at the same time, this year, Democrats are energized and angry. And the question is, you know, will these rallies inject enough urgency among the Republican base to hold a firewall against Democratic gains? We'll find out on November 6. Our guest today is Jake Zuckerman, a politics reporter for the Charleston Gazette-Mail. Jake covers state and federal politics with a focus on where politics, money, and influence collide. You can find him reporting, running, reading U.S. history, or hanging out at the red carpet.
Well, let's talk real quick. You know, I was going to lead with the Senate race, and we'll come to that in a minute, but I want to talk about the governor's press conference yesterday and what that means for the fall, because that's kind of like, back in February, I guess, you know, that we were in the middle of the teacher's strike, and I think that's when the first time I met you in person. And this would seem to be, you know, I think the governor would probably like this to be a resolution to that, but the timing is interesting and the way it could play out in the fall. So tell me a little bit about that press conference yesterday, and we could talk about what it means.
Sure. Well, you know, at the press conference, and bear in mind that the teacher strike was all about teacher pay raise and PEI, public employees insurance benefits. And it ended with basically a freeze to the current insurance structure and 5% pay raise for teachers. Technically, I think it was a 5% pay raise based on the average set. It was a $2,020 pay raise for teachers, essentially. And yesterday at a press conference, the governor, I mean, it was an absolutely political event. It was in the governor's official office and in his official capacity, but he had something like a pump-up video to lead him out there. He brought up an armload of Republican delegates and senators, and he said that given some good revenue numbers the state's seen, there have been big revenue spikes in personal income taxes and corporate net income taxes. So he said that we're going to have $100 million and he's going to fork it over to PEIA to improve benefits and keep costs frozen, at least in the short run, and then give teachers and all state employees another 5% raise. But you sit in that room and you would have thought it was a political rally. I mean, this was an ostensibly political event, and it kind of just goes to show that the politics of the strike are still present and they're still palpable. And we're 34 days out from an election, if memory serves. So I think it just goes to show you what's on people's mind as November inches in.
Right. I mean, I think a lot of national press were shorthanding the teacher strike as for pay. But, when I came to the Capitol and talked to actual teachers, it was more about PEIA and the benefits. I mean, the pay was part of it for sure. But you know, they were just as torqued up, if not more, about their benefits package. It seemed, you know, a lot of people were pretty upset with Republicans. You know, I talked to Democrats and Republicans both among those teachers, as I'm sure you did. Do you see, does that strike have some, I mean, the governor's action the other day would seem to indicate that strike is continuing to resonate in the campaigns for the state, for State House and State Senate. Do you see that as well on the ground?
Well, that's another interest. I'm glad you mentioned that, because if you took what the governor said at face value, you know, the line is that Republicans gave us this pay raise. Republicans made this all happen. Republicans froze PEIA. And if you go back to the teacher strike, immediately when it was over, that was the line. I mean, I'm talking hours after legislation was signed. I remember Mitch Carmichael, Senate president and speaker at the time, Tim Armstead, holding a press conference to essentially say, you're welcome. But if you go back to the strike itself, Republicans really were just this force of resistance, especially in the Senate. And, you know, everything, they were concerned about revenue estimates. They were concerned about where the money was going to come from. They were concerned about, should we even do this? They were telling the teachers to get back to work. The attorney general was threatening to sue the teachers if they didn't get back to work for what he called an unlawful strike. So there's a blame game. And on the converse, there's the look what we did game. Everyone's trying to claim credit for this big thing. And I think that what the vote might show is, who do people think made this happen? Who do they think were really the agents of this pay raise and this PEIA freeze? And to what you were saying about PEIA itself, you know, West Virginia teachers, their salary is comparatively low to other states, but the average salary is better than the average West Virginian salary. But that said, if insurance costs go up every year and they don't get pay raises commensurate with those cost increases, effectively their salary is being eaten away at every year. So I think that, and it wasn't just, it's not just national media that didn't get that. To be frank, if local media were slow to understand that, I think the legislature was slow to understand that. And I think we really saw when that first pay raise was passed, I think it was a 2% pay raise with some subsequent raises coming out years. And the union leaders negotiated that. The teachers kept on striking. They said, no way, that's not going to cut it.
Yeah, I remember a conversation I had with a teacher that told me, you know, there was, you know, with regard to the teacher pay and the benefits, that they're definitely linked, that, you know, they had teachers who'd taken on second jobs to help make the ends meet, but then that blew back on them when it came time to evaluate their benefits and how much they made, and it kind of actually hurt them in other ways. You know, one thing I remember, and I think most people who were in the Capitol, are just the constant chants. And I mention that because, you know, each district is different. The dynamic in each race is, you know, unique to that race. But I don't remember. I remember hearing a lot of chants against the governor. I remember hearing, move, Mitch, get out the way, targeted at Mitch Carmichael, the Senate president. Mm-hmm. I don't remember much chance, anti-democratic chance. So do you think that, you know, you mentioned how Republicans have tried to sort of do some legislative jujitsu and claim credit when they were the ones being targeted? Do you think, I mean, obviously we'll know on election day, but what's your reporting telling you about whether that's translated to voters and school personnel in particular?
Well, I think it's just an absolute fact. No, that we're really an anti-democratic chance.
I'm sorry, say that again.
I would have heard them.
Did you say there was no
chanting against.
Okay. All right.
There were not. I just don't think that ever happened. But yeah, and you know, I think there is some truth to the statement that at the end of the day, it's a Republican governor, it's a Republican legislature. The majority really calls the shots. Maybe they did get rolled. You know, maybe it took this massive strike, this massive union effort, and a lot of Democratic pressure and a lot of public scrutiny to roll the Republicans, to acquiesce to this pay raise. But I think that there is an argument there that, you know, at the end of the day, it's a Republican byproducts of public policy, or at least in some way attributable to Republicans, all the Republicans in the House and Senate.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's, you know, that I wanted to, are you there, Jake?
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry if I interrupted. I'm having a little bit of dropout, but it's not nearly as bad as it was the other night. I think we can work with this. So I wanted to lead with the strike because it, you know, who knows how the history books will read 20 or 50 years from now, but that does seem to be a historic mm-hmm. moment in West Virginia politics. And, you know, in the context of the moment, it spread to other states. We saw other states pick it up. So that's, I feel like it's important to lead with that in terms of the overall atmosphere. Do you, I wanted to talk about the Senate race, unless you had other thoughts about the state legislative races before we move on to the U.S. Senate race.
No, let's do it.
So, you know, that's, the national media was swooping in for the teacher strike in February and early March. Now they're coming in for the Manchin race. And I guess I would include myself among that number, even though it's, you know, practically next door for me. Tell me a little bit about the Senate race. You know, it's Trump's made two visits now on behalf of Attorney General Patrick Morrissey, the Republican challenger. We're seeing a lot of money in this race. It seems like most of the pundits have it leaning Democratic. What's your 10,000 foot read?
Right. Well, the polling average is somewhere between 8 to 10% on independent polls in favor of Manchin. So that's a good sign. And you know, if you believe and you trust the political chattering class, yeah, I think that there was a lot more scrutiny about how vulnerable Manchin was maybe a few months ago than there really is now. If you dig into the polls, what's interesting is, well, although they're both not seen as especially favorable, Patrick Morrissey has a big favorability problem and also just a big who is this guy kind of problem. I remember seeing that in the West Virginia poll, about 33% of voters approved of the job he's doing, 33% disapproved, but 33% just didn't really know anything about him. And, you know, he's held statewide office. He won in 2012 and started serving in 2013. So you'd think that there would be a little bit more awareness over who he is and who he is not. So no, that definitely surprised me. But yeah, I think Manchin is comfortable, and I guess I don't know what value the president's visit has. I know you're going to see a short-term bump in polling, and maybe some of that'll bake in. But it could be anyone's guess right now. I know I talked to Patrick Morrissey the other day, and just in passing, I was heading out of an event he was hosting, and he was telling me, don't believe these polls, we're going to win this thing. I mean, how much of that is just political spin and trying to get the media to show some confidence, or, you know, does he really just not trust his polling? I mean, pollsters don't have the most sterling of reputations after the 2016 election, so it's anyone's grab.
Yeah, I think my understanding is polling in West Virginia has kind of been notoriously dicey. It's hit or miss. Sometimes it's pretty on, sometimes not so much. Do you have any sense of how this race compares to Morrissey's past races? I know you started, you know, covering after the 2016, you fell into this beat after the 2016 election, but, you know, I've heard talk that Morrissey's previous races were kind of the same, and that he was behind in some polling early on, and just partly through the strategy now, which is tying his opponent to the national Democratic establishment in D.C., he was able to kind of come back toward the end of the campaign. Do you get the sense that well, number one, is that true, you know, of those past races? And two, do you see a potential, is that a potential pattern that could play out here?
Sure. Well, I wouldn't speak to the National Democratic Party. I mean, I haven't seen that in coverage, but I wouldn't deny that that was a factor. But what I would say is that there's some interesting parallels in either race. In 2012, he was running against McGraw, and that's just kind of synonymous name with old guard politics, old guard Democratic politics, I should say. And I think that there were a lot of Democrats who voted for Patrick Morrissey because, geez, you know, how long has a McGraw been in this office right now? And I think that was when the tide was really turning for Republicans in the state. That was when they were, maybe it was probably closer to 2014, but 2012 was pretty close to that tipping point of West Virginia just not being this Democratic stronghold that it was. And in 2016, I know the polling definitely had him behind before the race. But when you have Donald Trump on the ballot, that's a volatile electorate. And you know that there are a lot of registered Democrats that are voting for Trump. With Hillary Clinton on top, I think it's safe to say that a lot of registered Democrats were a little apathetic about her, especially in West Virginia. I mean, she got clobbered in the primary, and that bleeds over into a general. And now, at least, if you listen to Trump's rhetoric at these Morrissey rallies, I mean, sure, he's endorsing Patrick Morrissey, but he's really saying, and I think it's pretty close to explicitly saying, you're going out here and you're voting for me right now. I know I'm not on the ballot, but go vote for Patrick Morrissey, because that's a vote for me, which I think is an interesting comment.
Yeah, the impression I got from both the rally the other night in Johnson City, Tennessee, where we have a competitive open seat U.S. Senate race, and also the line from the two Morrissey rallies is, you know, he's essentially trying to put himself on the ballot and make it a referendum on himself, because in those red states, that's a favorable look for Republican candidates in an otherwise dismal atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
I want to zoom back a little bit to the primaries, because, you know, in the general, we kind of have this dichotomy. You have these two candidates and we can play compare and contrast. But as you know from doing this, the fault lines run a little deeper. There are some different factions that you don't always see in the bright line general election. But Manchin faced a pretty progressive challenger in the primary in Paula Jean Swearengen. And, you know, he seems to me, like, I've always kind of heard this argument, and where there are closely divided bodies, that a person will come in and say, I can be independent of my party, I can be in the middle, and that makes me a crucial swing vote, and because of that, I can leverage things for my constituents. The flip side of being in the middle like that is that you also get shot at by everybody, and certainly I think Manchin seems pretty unpopular with the Democratic progressives in West Virginia. Can you talk a little bit about the primary and some of that, how that dynamic played out?
Yeah, well, you had Paula Jean Swearingen. She had a lot of former Bernie Sanders staffers working for her. She really had that blue progressive base, you know, like ACT Blue funded, environmentally focused, healthcare focused campaign, Medicare for all kind of stuff. But I think you saw Joe Manchin really try to keep her at arm's length. I mean, really try to, actually, I think I have that expression totally backward. He tried to keep his distance from her. He never debated her. I think he said that he would debate her. He said he was open to it, but it never worked out. And I think that was just an effort to keep her name recognition down and just not play into it too much. And I don't know how seriously people really took her, but then on May 8th, she just nabbed 30% of the vote. I mean, that's no joke. That's a daunting sign, I think, is a safe statement. And she's out there in the well, you know, I have trouble imagining that they're going to against Patrick Morrissey, but I think it comes back to some of that admitting with Hillary Clinton, and that are they going to go out to the polls and vote for Manchin? Are they going to write someone in? Are they going to look for an independent candidate, or are they just going to have that mentality of, well, I'm not voting for Manchin no matter what. I'm maybe I won't vote in the race, but I'm not voting for Manchin.
Yeah, I mean, anecdotally, every Democrat, every progressive, I should say, I interviewed, with one exception, you know, they may have banged on Manchin, but they said they're still going to vote for him over Morrissey. I heard that repeated a few times. I even caught some criticism on Twitter from someone that was trying to use me as a stand-in for Manchin when I'm just a journalist. But even they said, you know, Manchin's terrible, but Morrissey's worse. The one exception I heard was Charlotte Britt, who told me she was not going to vote for Joe Manchin under any circumstances. And I think, you know, with her specific story of her defeating him in 96 in the primary for governor and then he wouldn't endorse her, I think that's understandable from a personal level. But I don't know, it's indicative of progressives generally in the state. Let's talk about the Republican primary a little. I mean, do you have thoughts on that?
Well, I do. I mean, just this week, I think there was one really interesting thing that happened, and there were some activists who staged a sit-in at Manchin's office calling on him to deny the confirmation of Brett Kavanaugh. And while they were in there, they were really threatening to, you know, if he votes to confirm Kavanaugh, they're going to try to vote him out. And I don't think that Patrick Morrissey is going to be any defender of Roe v. Wade. I think he's made as much perfectly clear that he is a pro-life candidate. He is with Kavanaugh. He's voiced support for Kavanaugh from the get-go. So I think that it's, you know, I wouldn't say that they speak for everyone by any chance, but that was a very loud progressive statement that we're done with Joe. I mean, if he's not with us here, he's not with us ever, and we're against him.
Yeah, I was going to talk about that after the Republican primary, but maybe let's
it
now. No. I think it's important. I mean, you had 9 people arrested in his office, and that seems to be like the one thing that could trip him up headed into the general is that he's kind of in between a rock and a hard place with this Kavanaugh nomination, just because it'll alienate Democrats if he goes for Kavanaugh. And if he votes against him, then Morrissey's going to use that as a cudgel to try to nationalize the race even more, it feels like to me. And I think Manchin's maybe crossing his fingers and hope the nomination is withdrawn, or at the very least, he's not the one, you know, he's not the deciding vote.
Mm-hmm.
In which case, you know, if he's the deciding vote, then there'll be, you know, 50 other senators who could also be the deciding vote, or 49 if it comes down to Pence. But yeah, I don't know. It seems like he's kind of stuck in terms of trying to both please his base, but also swing voters in West Virginia. How do you think Kavanaugh plays in West Virginia?
Well, I guess I remember thinking, and you know, I was there and I was watching all the events unfold late Monday, and what just kept running through my mind was, you know, actions have consequences, decisions have consequences, but sometimes you forget that inactions and indecisions also have consequences too. And there's political strategy to, you know, to borrow the phrase, keep your powder dry, not lay the line down in the sand. But yeah, like you were saying, everyone has, I think there are about 5 or 6 senators who haven't really taken a position question here on the nomination, there's an advantage to if you just, I mean, say I'm a senator right now. And I just say I'm against Brett Kavanaugh, and that's a big headline for a day. But then for the whole rest of the confirmation, everyone's looking at those undecided senators. So I'd have to disagree with you that, you know, he has the cover of all the other people who vote with him. When you stay out of this, and when everyone keeps asking you day in and day out, what are you going to do? What are you going to do? What are you going to do? And if you just keep ducking the question, eventually you're going to be one of the last people to decide, and that makes your vote really the effective deciding vote.
Yeah, that's a fair point. And I wasn't arguing that he'd have cover otherwise. I guess my, you know, if I was to elaborate a little bit, what I would mean is that some of the other voters who are late deciders may also be targeted as the deciding vote. So that deciding vote, quote unquote, will be leveraged against multiple individuals. Not that it's cover by any stretch. That's not the point I'm making. So as far as Morrissey goes, you know, he's kind of making this argument, trying to nationalize the race. He's trying to make it a referendum on Trump as well. But I guess the question I wanted to ask is what does this campaign and the primary he just came through mean for the future of the Republican Party in West Virginia?
Can you ask that one more time?
So he came through this primary with Evan Jenkins, was sort of his primary opponent, and then, you know, and Don Blankenship was more of a secondary opponent in the primary. But all three of them were sort of in the scrum. Morrissey emerged victorious. So, you know, within the context of that, what does that mean for the future of the Republican Party in West Virginia? And, you know, maybe not much, because I guess you have the governor who's also a Republican. Some of this I'm thinking about through the lens of Virginia, where Republicans haven't won statewide in a while, and they have sort of a problematic statewide candidate on top of the ballot this year. So maybe it's not so much of a factor in West Virginia. I am interested in your observations from the primary and what that tells us about where West Virginia Republican Party is at the moment with its candidates.
It was a weird primary. I mean, to, you know, if you just look at these three guys and they just have these political histories that I can't imagine would have flown elsewhere in American political history. I mean, you look at Evan Jenkins, and that guy was a Democrat for years and years and years in the legislature, and then just up and switches parties. And make no mistake, I mean, he was a reliable conservative vote the whole time he was in the House, and likely would have been in the Senate. But, you know, that was almost old hat through the primary. That was just, and I think people in other states were just baffled by that. Like, what do you mean that this Republican, I mean, this staunch Republican was a Democrat 4 years ago? And what do? You shrug your shoulders and that's welcome to West Virginia. Or you look at Don Blankenship, the guy was in jail until May of 2017. He has this unbelievable amount of political baggage. He faced federal trial. People launched, a guy like Booth Goodwin launched, or at least attempted to launch, a gubernatorial bid off prosecuting Don Blankenship and getting a white-collar criminal into jail, which doesn't happen often in this country. Don Blankenship still pulled 20% of the vote, still fared second in, I think, more counties than people really realized. Or you look at Patrick Morrissey, a guy who was, you know, he ran for Congress in the early 2000s in another state. He was a lobbyist for a long time for the pharmaceutical industry. He's held statewide office for about 6 years now, and he's out there saying, drain the swamp and get rid of these career politicians. And, you know, if that's not a career politician, I don't know what is, but it was a bizarre primary, to say the least.
Yeah, maybe that's a good transition because Morrissey didn't win anything in southern West Virginia. Arguably, the third congressional district where Donald Trump won by nearly 50 points 2 years ago, that's arguably Manchin's strongest area. And we have a competitive House race there. What's going on? Why, number one, I guess, why didn't what's with Morrissey's troubles in southern West Virginia?
Right. Well, I think there were a couple things at play. For one, Evan Jenkins was a congressman down there. So obviously he's just got a natural structural advantage in the district, and he's going to pull a lot of votes from Patrick Morrissey. And, you know, maybe the further north you go, the more reviled a figure Don Blankenship would be. But down there, you know, I saw a lot of good reporting from West Virginia Public Broadcasting, and that a lot of people still really like him because, A, they believe his line that he was, say, a veteran of the war on coal and a wounded warrior of the war on coal. And also a guy of that wealth gave a lot to the community. And there are a lot of viable arguments that he took a lot from the community. He was people died in his mines. There were a lot of very substantial environmental concerns, but, you know, he built football fields for high schools that needed them. He gave back, and I think just having a local boy makes good thing makes a big difference. So I think that both those factors pulled a lot of Morrissey's votes. Now, the question is, what are those people going to do? What are the people in the third district who voted for Evan Jenkins or Don Blankenship? Are they going to come over to Morrissey, or are they going to go over to Joe Manchin? Because, you know, Patrick Morrissey tries to frame Joe Manchin as this enemy of the coal industry and to try to align him with Hillary Clinton, but I don't really think there's a ton of evidence to suggest that Joe Manchin is any kind of progressive environmentalist by any political measurement. So, and then you look at, you know, how will Richard Ojeda's race against Carol Miller impact that race? I don't know. I wish I knew, but I don't.
Right. Yeah. It does seem like that race, if nothing else, will juice turnout, but that's just an assumption on my part too. Just because it seems like a competitive race, polling has shown different things. You know, the New York Times in their live polling exercise showed Miller was up 48-40, although it's notable she hasn't crossed that 50% mark either. Tell us about Richard Ojeda.
Ojeda's a pistol, man. you know, I'd say my favorite Ojeda story, I try to avoid words like grandstanding, you know, words that just kind of have this loaded context. But I once, I think, wrote out in a tweet that Ojeda was grandstanding because he was literally, during the teacher strike, screaming from the Senate floor to all the teachers in the grandstands about, this is what the Republicans are doing to you. I mean, I've never actually seen the most literal definition of grandstanding politically before. He's fiery. He's loud. He makes his presence known. I mean, the teachers were chanting his name. You'd have thought he was a football star, that whole teacher strike. He's picked up all this national media, and I think that there's this romantic idea of where the Democrats need to go, and that they need maybe some more conservative voices from the heartland that are going to bring back that union side of Democrats instead of the identity politics side that, in the postmortem of 2016, people say really doomed the party. So Ojeda kind of fits in more with this Tim Ryan mold. And he's likable, he's loud, he shoots from the hip. For better or for worse, he's honest, and he'll always talk, which I think is new. And maybe it is that he does these Facebook Live videos and just, he's like a fire hose and just lets it all out. And it certainly will be used against him. But on the flip side, here's a guy who's running for office that you ask him a question, he'll answer it.
Yeah. Would you call him a populist, you think?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And, you know, he'll say things that are just abjectly untrue. I mean, I remember interviewing him, and I think, God, I can't remember the exact statistic, but he's a very pro-marijuana candidate. He thinks that it should be legal medically, and I think he's open to it recreationally. Wants some more information, but he once told me some crazy amount of people are in jail because of marijuana-related crimes, and there certainly are a lot of people in jail for marijuana-related crimes in the United States, but nowhere near what he said, and I just had to interrupt him and say, come on, that's just not true, and his response would be like, well, yeah, but you get my point, and he'll just move on, and I come back to this phrase, shoots from the hip. I mean, that's Ojeda.
Yeah, you know, the word I've used for him, I haven't used grandstanding, I've used pugilistic, just because he seems like he wants to punch, you know, whoever the issues or whatever. I mean, he just seems like a fighter. you know, and that goes with his personal story about getting jumped ahead of the 2016 primary. But in that way, though, I think he's drawn a very challenging opponent in Carol Miller. I mean, regardless of the district demographics, I think he would have had a more straightforward campaign against Rupi Phillips, for example, another Democrat turned Republican. And with Miller, it's a little harder. You know, I had a Republican operative in West Virginia describe her as like, she's like, you know, your best friend's grandmother. And so it's hard to like come at her with a direct attack. I mean, that's not stopped him. He, you know, when I, last time I talked to him, he was talking about her getting up and announcing that the course at this particular legislative caucus was going to be filet mignon. And he was going after her on that, you know, saying, well, she's not a farmer. But I do think it, you know, especially with the atmosphere this year, it's harder for him to, you know, directly attack her as it would, you know, it's a little bit more difficult for him to make that argument than it would be if he had a male opponent who is a little, you know, harder Republican than she is. What's your assessment of Carol Miller? You definitely know her better than I.
Well, the hard truth is I don't know her very well because, and this is where I think Ojeda has found some room to go after her. You just don't see a lot of her. I mean, you see her on TV, you see her ads. So I guess you see a lot of this paid media. You don't see her in newspapers. You don't see her on the news. He can't get her to do a town hall. You don't see her out at big rallies anywhere. And, you know, I'm not saying she's not campaigning, but she keeps to herself and she keeps quiet, which is just such a stark contrast to the pugilist, if you will.
Right. I mean, I've kind of thought of her as a version of Shelley Moore Capito, you know, Virginia's or West Virginia's other U.S. senator who's up, I guess, next cycle, in that she's second generation. You know, Carol Miller's father was a congressman from Ohio, I believe.
Yep.
You know, she's not loud and in your face. She seems reasonable from a distance. And so a lot of ways she seems to sort of be a, you know, Shelley Moore Capito 2.0.
Right. Well, I think that the difference there would be to Senator Capito's credit, she's much more willing to do interviews. And I think she knows policy. I would never take that from her. But, you know, I remember one of the few times I've really gotten an interview with Carol Miller, and I was just asking her what she's going to do with healthcare or what she's going to do with, you know, policy point X or Y. And her answer was, I'll figure it out when I get there. And, you know, maybe there's a lot of truth in that, you know, you can say whatever you want on the campaign, but you have to really get there and dig in and learn how Congress works. And I do understand that, but I was pretty floored in that. I mean, how, you know, she says that we want to repeal Obamacare. Great. So how do we stabilize healthcare markets? I'll figure it out when I get there. I mean, that's daunting for someone to take this really what I think is more of a messaging line than a coherent policy of we're going to repeal the Affordable Care Act, to not have any idea of what should go on, especially if your problem is that the Affordable Care Act has totally unstabilized healthcare markets. It's led to rising premiums. Okay. Sure, so how do we stabilize the market and keep premiums down? To say, I don't know, but I'm ready to just yank what we do have in place, I think is daunting. I think it's more political than any sort of policy. And I just remember really taking time to process that. And I think that there's a legitimate concern, and Ojeda was all over her for that one of, you know, Carol wants to get to Congress, but won't even say what she's going to do when she gets there. And this is a woman who's been in the public policy arena for a long time. She's a House Majority Whip. She's been around state politics. And I don't know. I thought there was going to be more there. And even in her ads, you don't see a ton of policy.
Yeah. And I spoke with her back during the primary, and what you're describing more or less squares with my perception of her. She kind of talked in generalities about her biography, about her Buffalo farm. She talked about working on the board of Lily's Place, you know, for infants suffering from opioid withdrawal and Huntington. And yet she didn't really provide a lot of red meat as far as policy goes. She didn't provide a lot of specifics. And, you know, the grandma thing holds true, too, because at the end of the conversation, she started asking about me, and she goes, well, you sound like a very interesting young man, and blah, 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 which, I think there is something to that personal touch in terms of politics and personal style. You touched on something there. I'd like to just sidebar a little bit and talk, have a conversation about policy and politics of healthcare. You know, a lot of Republicans have campaigned on repealing Obamacare, you know, since it was passed. But I think with Obama now out of the White House and Donald Trump in, we're starting to see some evolution on that. You know, Senator Capito talked about concern for maintaining Medicaid expansion and coverage of pre-existing conditions. Those were both, you know, explicitly parts of Obamacare. You know, and here in Virginia, we saw this year Appalachian Republicans partnering with Democrats to expand Medicaid. We're seeing Joe Manchin literally shoot Patrick Morrisey's lawsuit to overturn Obamacare, which he, you know, was hanging on the issue of pre-existing conditions. Let me set it up with this question. Do West Virginians like the Affordable Care Act or no?
Well, see, that's the crux of the whole thing. Do they like the Affordable Care Act? Maybe not, but I think what you're seeing a lot of Democrats gamble on is they don't like the Affordable Care Act, but they like all the provisions and all the really policy of the Affordable Care Act, which sounds like a contradiction. But, you know, like if you look at the way Manchin discusses Patrick Morrisey's lawsuit, and I first saw this pointed out in Trip Gabriel's story in the New York Times from around Labor Day, you don't hear him saying Patrick Morrisey is trying to take away Obamacare. You don't hear him saying he's trying to take away the Affordable Care Act. You hear him, he's going after pre-existing conditions. And now, you know, you don't need to be a sociologist to know that West Virginia, with the broadest brush, is older, poorer, obese, and sicker, i.e. an unbelievable amount of people in the state have pre-existing conditions. He throws around this number, 800,000. I think I've seen Kaiser Health Foundation, a nonpartisan, really healthcare policy organization, put it somewhere, God, I want to say between 400,000 and 500,000. The point is, you know, there are a lot of West Virginians who have pre-existing conditions whose insurance rates are artificially kept down because of provisions of the Affordable Care Act. And Manchin characterizes Patrick Morrisey's lawsuit as an attack on pre-existing conditions. And, you know, if you read the actual suit from the Texas Attorney General, the argument goes that the Affordable Care Act was only a tax bill because of the individual mandate to purchase health care, which was revoked in the tax reform package last year. Therefore, if there's no tax provision bill, the whole thing is in effect. And I'm not an attorney. I know there are arguments of severability to be dealt with. I couldn't give you any informed opinion what the court's going to do with the lawsuit. But what's interesting is that Manchin is trying to thread this needle between not talking about Obamacare, but talking about pre-existing conditions, which was, you know, pre-existing conditions is one of the most key parts of the law. So I think he's trying to play this game of law without really mentioning the law. And, you know, like that ad you mentioned, if you look closely, you actually see the cover sheet of the lawsuit, and then in just big red letters, it's pre-existing conditions lawsuit. Campy, it's kind of tacky. But, and you're seeing that strategy trickle down. I know I've heard Tally Sargent talking about it and using the same kind of rhetoric. I've seen, and she's running for Congress in the 2nd District against incumbent Alex Mooney. I've heard Ojeda using similar lines. I think I've heard Kendra Fiché up in the 1st District borrow some of that phrasing. So I think you're seeing this new focus on healthcare, and they found this sweet spot of don't talk about Obama, don't talk about the law, talk about what the law did for if those provisions are gone. Does that make sense?
It does. No, it does. It's, you know, I've always joked, or the line I've been using lately was referencing Nancy Pelosi's famous line about we have to pass the bill so you can find out what's in it. People found out what's in it, and they like parts of it a lot. Mm-hmm. And I think that's, you know, it's a messaging question, right? I mean, that's what you're talking about is the Republicans are calling it Obamacare and coming at it from one angle. Democrats are talking about the stuff people like in it, Medicaid expansion, pre-existing condition coverage. And so it's more of a messaging question than it is policy. I mean, they're intermixed, they're interlaced, but I think we're seeing play out in these midterms. Briefly, in first and second, you know, do either of those Democrats have a shot to win? It seems like most of the national pundits don't think so. I haven't heard much talk about either one of those races, but someone who's on the ground reporting on it, I'm curious as to your thoughts on those two races.
Are you talking about Tally and Kendra?
Yeah.
Okay. Ooh. I have trouble imagining it, but I wouldn't put it beyond the realm of possibility. Tally Sargent has been really working the district. She held town halls in all, I think it's 17 counties in the district. You see her out knocking doors. She's got a presence, but that said, it's a Republican district. I mean, Alex Mooney won by wide margins. He's got money behind him. Both he and the other incumbent, David McKinley, are just not doing town halls. They're not debating out before the people. And I think that that's really hurting both the Democrats, and I would also argue is hurting the general public to see the meeting of the minds there and really figure out who these people are. But I have trouble imagining either of them could really flip the seat. I think that if there's a seat that could fall into Democratic control, it'd be in the third, but I wouldn't rule it out.
Right. When people talk about Trump country, a lot of times they're talking about West Virginia, and that's definitely a national media shorthand. What do you think about people using that term for West Virginia?
Drives me up a wall.
Why?
I think that national media have this, there's a problem. There's a geographical bias, you know, New York, LA, Chicago, et cetera. And just the usage of a phrase like Trump country really solidifies the fact that there's an us and them, and Trump country's over there and not over here. And, you know, there's always a criticism of national media of being parachute journalists, and that you fly in, you parachute down, you get your story, and you're gone. And, you know, there are logistical reasons behind that, sure. But when you just see these phrases like Trump country, it just seems to – it just feels like this is some kind of foreign land. And they're just here on some exploratory mission to figure out what's going on with this peculiar breed of human and then, you know, get back to Brooklyn. And it just – I was just reading What You're Getting Wrong About Appalachia by Elizabeth Catt.
Yes.
I might be totally butchering that pronunciation. And if she's hearing this, I apologize. But she makes a good point in that there was sort of this fetishization of McDowell County down in the southern part of the state, which went overwhelmingly for Trump by percentage. But if you look at just the numbers, it's a few people that were drunk. People in every state voted for Donald Trump, and it wasn't just – there's this myth that it was just white, male, rural, no college education voters, and it's really just not the case. And so I think that there's this idea that of who voted for Donald Trump and that West Virginia is just this Trump state. And for one, it negates these – there's really this rich labor history in West Virginia and all these progressive voices that are here, and they might not be everywhere, but they are here. This, I guess it's just too broad a brushstroke, and it just emphasizes this gap between the people who are doing the reporting and the people who are being reported on.
Yeah. My pushback is always looking at the top line presidential vote. I mean, because West Virginia has been voting Republican since 2000.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even in the areas that went hardest for Trump, you're still talking about roughly one out of four people still voting for the Democrat. And, you know, the other pushback, and Elizabeth makes this point in What You're Getting Wrong About Appalachia, and I think it holds statewide as well. you know, if you look at the numbers for West Virginia, the plurality of voters just didn't vote. It was people who did not vote. And that's probably true elsewhere, but West Virginia is near the bottom. It's in the top three or four states in terms of turnout for the election. So I think it's, yeah, I agree with you. It drives me up a wall too. You know, the sort of the next piece of that is then, you know, I think if you look at the Obama years, Republicans won a lot of Appalachia more broadly, you know, beyond just West Virginia. And so with a Republican in the White House, you know, the opposition party to the White House usually has gains in all four elections. Mm-hmm. And so I'm wondering, you know, do you expect Democrats to maybe start winning back some of these seats? And if so, what's their route to victory?
Well, you know, this Republicans have taken over the country on a federal level. And I think what you saw is state legislatures are this incubator of political talent. And I think Democrats kind of fell asleep with that realization and didn't really focus on getting, you know, young Democrats into these state legislative seats. And you look at West Virginia, I think there are 34 Democrats in the House right now. A good chunk of them are newer, but a lot of them are, you know, old guard Democrats. And I just think that there needs to be more emphasis on the all politics is local approach. And I think they need a lot more control of the parties to the states than the DNC. I don't think the DNC is in sync with a lot of the country. And it certainly is maybe nationally. It knows what it's doing, but, you know, I don't think that West Virginian Democrats want to hear, I don't even know who chairs the DNC now, but I can't imagine that they'd be met with open arms if they came in here and said, all right, guys, you done good this far. We're going to take over now. Right. So I think there needs to be some emphasis on local control for the Democrats.
Hey, Jake, thank you so much for the time, man. I appreciate you taking the time to speak to me today.
Happy to do it.
And that is our interview with Jake Zuckerman. Thank you for listening to Blue Ridge Free State. If you want to contact the show, find us at Ridge Free on Twitter and Facebook. You can also find me individually on Twitter at Mason Adams, MASONATOMS, like the atomic particle. Thanks to our guest Jake Zuckerman of the Charleston Gazette Mail. You can find Jake on Twitter at Jake_Zuckerman. Thanks again to POMAC and Stations for providing us with music. That's all for this episode. Looking forward, I do want to release one more episode before midterms, and I've got a guest lined up who can talk to us about the bigger picture, as well as zooming in on a few key races we'll be watching on election night. Thank you again for listening. We'll talk to you next time here on Blue Ridge Free State.